Hello and welcome to episode 18 of The Art of Conversation. Thank you so much for joining me. This episode, I am delighted to be joined by musician, poet and librarian Alan Dobbs. Alan's poetry collection, Top Garden Afterlife, was published only a few weeks ago by Red Books Press. The book is available to buy from Red Books Bookshop in Wexford Town or online via their website, theirishbookshop.com. And what a wonderful book it is. Cigarette Fog and 70s Girls, two decades off the track, shortened my life and broke my heart. Still, I wouldn't mind going back. Sadad is a word for a sad state of intense longing for someone or something that is absent. It is described as a kind of melancholy yearning. Melancholy means sad, and yearning is a strong, persistent longing or desire, especially for something unattainable. It describes, albeit not completely, comprehensively, Alan Dobbs's work reasonably voraciously. Alan has recorded several albums in the variety of styles and lives in Enniscorthy. Top Garden Afterlife is a debut collection of his writings. He invites the reader to join him in a dreamlike and enduring world sculpted through his words, one that perfectly accompanies the extremely visual soundscapes he is known for. This collection will hit you in the feels, but in a good way. You will walk around wanting more, and you will feel like you might just know your own soul a tiny bit better. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and thanks again to Alan for joining me.
So thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you.
So congratulations on the publication of your debut poetry collection with Red Books Press. What motivated you to release the book?
I suppose there was a couple of factors came into play. I probably would assert that it's more of a songbook with pieces of poetry kind of interspersed and pieces of short prose in there too. And I've been recording for a long time and had done several albums and recorded by myself, completely financed myself. And I suppose, in some respects, I didn't feel like I served the songs particularly well with that lo-fi kind of recording. And I thought the songs stood up lyrically. And yeah, it was sort of good to see them collected together. And there was also an element of drawing a line. The way I used to record, I've completely abandoned that now. The idea in the future will be to be more collaborative and to sort of expand the sound and expand the notion of what kind of album I make. So some of those songs were recorded, some of them aren't, but they were all written sort of during a specific period, I suppose. And just putting everything together, and I mean, even the pieces of poetry, the pieces of other writing, they're all related to those songs. So, but primarily it's a songbook, and I've drawn a line, as I said, and I'm working on the next thing I'm doing now, and it's going to be not completely different, obviously, but it will be something new. So I suppose that was the main kind of impetus behind getting the book out.
Your writing does lean towards more of a musical verse rather than a traditional poetic verse. What is the kind of inspiration behind that?
It just depends on how a piece comes together. Sometimes I might start a song and I just feel it's going nowhere, but I don't throw anything away. There's notebooks and notebooks and notebooks all over the place. And sometimes there will be a couple of lines in there that lend themselves to another song. Sometimes what I thought might have been a song will become a piece of poetry. But I suppose to a fault, I'm obsessed with the idea of the rhythm of words, the sort of placing together of words. I'll never let a line go out that I don't believe in, that I'm not happy with. And I don't have any particular kind of interest in formality or anything like that. So if a piece of poetry reads like a song or reads like a ballad or whatever, then I'm happy to just let it be what it's going to be. And I mean, there's going to be pieces. There are pieces in the book that don't have any relation whatsoever to sort of song craft or whatever. Whatever a piece is going to be, it's going to be as far as I'm concerned. And if it sounds good in terms of rhythm, if it works, I'm pleased enough to let it be what it is and let it have its own life and its own emotional life or whatever, and contain its own emotional information, I suppose. So that's really it. There really isn't any kind of thinking beyond that, really. Song's a song, poem is a poem, and whatever it decides it's going to be, then I let it do that.
Do you tend to intertwine your love for music and your history with music within your poetry?
In all honesty, I mean, I came at this whole thing as a songwriter or musician or whatever, and I mean, I would have thought of myself as a songwriter, chiefly as a songwriter, right up to when Top Garden Afterlife came out, or prior to when it came out, shortly prior to when it came out. But that's shifting now. That's changing now, and I've more of an interest in poetry than I did in the past. But I mean, like, I suppose my kind of heroes or inspirations or whatever would be people like Leonard Cohen, Nick Cave. There was a great songwriter who was also a dyed-in-the-wool published poet called David Berman. And he was a massive, massive influence on me. And I suppose all of those people, they just had a huge bearing on sort of what I thought of as songcraft, what I thought of as poetry, what I thought of as just a writer of words, you know. And it's a sort of a, it's a sphere that one can only aspire to, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How was the publishing process with an independent publishing press like Red Books?
Incredible. Incredible. I mean, I'm completely kind of indebted to them. Just the sort of generosity and graciousness that they took to the work. The book, you know, was just, it blew me away completely. Zeth is a friend of mine for the last couple of years, but I mean, Wally is just an amazing man, you know. I mean, just the fact that he's doing this, you know, regardless of my kind of involvement or input, sort of, I remember it just when I found out about it first, I just thought that's incredible. You know, because, you know, I mean, not even, it's just, even the bookshop is an amazing place, and the way he operates, everything he does with it, it's hugely impressive. And then when the Red Books press started, and the Wexford Bohemian thing started, and, you know, I was just very welcomed into the thing. And, you know, as I said, Zeth is also an amazing person. And it was just hugely, hugely positive experience. I can't stress that enough. It's just, you know, such a good, you know, it was just a very welcoming thing. And, you know, I never felt ill at ease or anything like that. You know, I mean, some people can be very hand-wringing about embarking on projects, or, you know, they'll procrastinate and hum and haw, and it might come to nothing. These are guys who just go, this is happening, we're doing it, and that's it. And I mean, you know, you won't, how often will you ever get that? in your life, in your writing life, or, you know, any kind of in your creative life, that the sort of life of the mind is supported to that extent. It's incredible.
Would you recommend Red Books Press to any writers interested in publishing their debut anthology?
I think with the praise that has that kind of feels, I absolutely would. I mean, it's a shot in the arm for any writer, and a huge kind of boost of confidence. Absolutely. Yeah, I can't kind of stress that enough.
As a librarian, do you think libraries do enough for local or budding writers?
I kind of have to be careful answering this, because I would say that I'm not kind of representing the library service in any way, shape or form in this situation here where we're talking. I think the libraries, even just from when I started at a very, very low level, even from the beginning, they seem to foster a huge degree of support for writers. They want writers in there, you know, they want writers to utilize the resources, the services. It gives a nice kind of environment for writers to gather. And it certainly did March 2020. The library services, it's a sort of a responsibility, I guess, that they feel, and a duty that they feel that they should do that, and they do that, you know. And writers keep coming back to the library service, you know, for that environment, for those resources. So absolutely, I think they can't do enough, really, you know.
How important are activities such as writers groups to the library community, and been kind of highlighted recently, especially?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, writers groups are hugely important to the fabric of the library service and the delivery of services, and it would be a strand of what happens with the library services if that was missing, if that was gone. And like a lot of people, you know, I mean, the library services would have missed delivering that strand to the various stakeholders, let's say. And it's obviously a gap, because full services could not resume for a long time, and people couldn't gather. And, you know, it keeps the lifeblood kind of pumping through what the libraries do. So it's a lack that was felt on both sides, I would imagine, you know, from the people delivering the service to the people availing of it. And that includes writers' groups, you know. I mean, you know, everybody, you know, it's integral to how these things run.
Could you enlighten us, what does the rabbit on the cover of your collection signify?
Okay, again, this is an answer that I have to be careful in terms of my wording. Well, first I'd say I found that rabbit in a kind of a flea store or thrift shop or whatever a few years ago. I don't actually remember where. I just kind of liked it. It looked very noble. It was very, very cheap, but it looked very, very noble. And there are elements of pieces in the book that kind of refer to various forms of carnality, is what I'll say. And somebody very kind of important to me uses the symbolism of the rabbit or the bunny when referring to me. I don't think I can say any more than that. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's very cute.
Yeah.
This is a question from a listener, mutual friend Zeph Ryder. Who would win in a fight, Leonard Cohen or Ernest Hemingway?
Hemingway. Okay. Hemingway. Listen. Hemingway was just tough. He was just a tough guy. Leonard was tough in a different way. He had a great degree of intestinal fortitude. But, you know, I mean, if he'd fought Hemingway in the early 1960s, Leonard's mother would have had to have come and got him and brought him home, you know. Hemingway was a bruiser. When Leonard went to Cuba, I think his mother had to write him a letter to get him out of there to the authorities, you know. But, you know, Leonard had a different kind of toughness. He had a different kind of ingredient, whereas just Hemingway was very, very handy with his fists. You've only got to ask somebody like Wallace Stevens or somebody like that. You know, Wallace Stevens was this sort of Republican poet way back in the early to mid 20th century, I think. And he got very lippy with Hemingway, and Hemingway pretty much cleaned his clock straight away. But I think it was sort of laid to rest then. You know, he took his kind of hiding and that was okay.
Alan, that was brilliant. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Alana.
Thanks, Emil.
Okay.